Hi, Josh. Happy New Year. It's Chris Neal, and I'm here with six friends up on the northern coast of California on the, first day of 2013, and we're going to talk to you, leaning into my laptop, about accessibility in the avant-garde.
And I'm going to start with a question about a slightly different avant-garde of a sort. One thing that was striking about political events in the Bay Area and Oakland in 2011-2012 is that the Grammy froth of Occupy Oakland, fairly radical, fairly militant, what you might call a kind of avant-garde, somehow managed to select the number one hit by Rihanna as their anthem, which is a strange, actually existing relationship between the avant-garde and accessibility that I wanted to sort of throw out as a provocation or just an oddity, and see what people here had to make of that.
So I have a context-setting question for that, which is, it seems as though seeing that juxtaposition as strange implies that a group of political protesters would usually not necessarily be interested in something like a top 40 song as an anthem, and I don't know if that's actually always necessarily the case. I mean, I think that's something that you've talked about before, so I just wonder if you see this as a kind of completely unique juxtaposition, and that's why we're talking about it, or if it has a sort of larger context.
Yeah, I mean, I like that question because it does imply maybe some of the assumptions that went into earlier conversations about accessibility in the avant-garde, that those are two things that are opposed to each other, that they're relevant things to juxtapose, that would be surprising. It's possible that what's interesting and great about it isn't that it's surprising, but that it happened, and that it's like a great song for that occasion or for those people, but I like the question for sure.
Well, I think that the reason it's surprising or that there's a tension there, and there was a tension, right? There actually were people involved in that political moment who sort of objected to this song being forwarded or celebrated. And their line, I think, essentially was this, right, that the political movement was anti-capitalist. And that was the underlying unnamed term. We talk about the avant-garde and accessibility in this case. And that thus this accessibility also stood for a kind of, like, the satisfying object of capitalism that was desirable and that everybody liked and that was agreed on as a successful commodity. And thus one would expect the movement to reject such matters and transcend them, and yet, notably, they didn't. And for me, that's where the tension arises, is the presence and absence of that unspoken sort of set of agreements around what an anti-capitalist politics relationship to culture or cultural production would be.
Well, it seems that in the case of the Rihanna song, what we're talking about is not accessibility so much as danceability. That was, in a sense, the test of whether a song could function like that, whether, a lot of people could get down, as it were, to the song. And not every song will serve that purpose.
Is there a way to transpose that to questions having to do with poetry?
Well, I think that whenever you talk about accessibility, you're also talking about audience and mode of address. A song that's played at the demo and that's meant to get a march excited has a certain form of address that's very different than the chamber music of experimental poetry, as it were.
Yeah. I grew up in a generation where all the chants at marches were really boring. Hey, hey, ho, ho, homophobia's got to go. Like, boring. 2, 4, 6. I don't know. They were dumb and boring. And then sometime around 1999, 2000, ultramundialists of various kinds discovered the anapest, and, like, the chants got a lot better. And it wasn't the movement I was involved with anymore, so I was watching it from a greater distance, but I was really happy about the advance over 2, 4, 6, 8. That was exciting. So, yeah, there's, like, a danceability poetry juncture there somewhere.
Well, I think the other thing that occurs to me, and I think this is maybe not a debate between Perloff and the respondent, but rather a debate that she's kind of talking about within her own essay, concerns the possibility for sort of affect that inheres within citation. You know, that's one of the things that she talks about in her own piece, is that the critique of this kind of more experimental poetry is that if it's so dependent on this really self-conscious, citational kind of aesthetic, then where do you find the person who's speaking? And I think that that's actually, that question seems very relevant to the whole, to the pop music construct as well, which is also deeply citational and yet at the same time, very successful at producing affect and affective response.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that would certainly go to, I mean, along with citation, the question of originality in some sense, which, A, comes up in the avant-garde discussion in that this question. One of the projects of neoconceptual poetry is to call into question originality as such and new creativity, right? It's uncreative, or at least so it periodically promises, although it takes back that promise over and over again by then returning to the sort of discourse of doing the new thing and of invention. I know some of us have talked about this, how the discourse of like, well, we're like scientists mixing up this new, you know, doing this new kind of creative work. And so that question sort of originality transposed onto the question of popular culture or something like that, where often songs are condemned for being unoriginal, but then they're also quite beloved for successfully assembling the parts in a way that people find convivial.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in short, and then I want to ask a question to the table, but it seems to me that the popular and the pre-modern both give the lie to the idea that there's something necessarily crucial about, or necessarily telling about, an originality-unoriginality divide. Popular songs are unoriginal in all the best ways, and we exist in the aftermath of a history of using texts in devotional, citational, and unoriginal ways that are just part of our heritage, and they seem to give a lie to that as a telling or important distinction, at least in my mind. The question I wanted to ask, though, is that somebody at the table before the recording began was saying something interesting that I wanted to hear more about assumptions around the intelligence of your audience.
Yeah, I think this might connect back to the question of the Rihanna song, because one thing we didn't mention was the way that the audience turned its interpretation. We Found Love is properly understood to be about Rihanna and Chris Brown and the impossibility of the relationship in the wake of the domestic violence scandal.
Yeah.
And in the context of the Oakland Commune, the we becomes the radical grouping of Oakland comrades and the impossibility of downtown Oakland. Mm-hmm. And this kind of interpretive move or the transportability of linguistic figures doesn't really make it into any of the questions posed.
Yeah, yeah. And it matters that it's the hopeless place, right? I don't know if that's actually in the title of the song, or maybe it's in the parentheses after the title of the song, but it's We Found Love in a Hopeless Place, and that seemed to be part of the fun and the pathos of choosing that song, though I wasn't there.
I mean, I think one of the things that troubles me about the accessibility debate is often this assumption that you are participating in a kind of language game or a practice that other people want to be a part of. And I just think oftentimes that's not true.
Yeah.
Nobody really wants to be a part of your game.
Yeah.
And so we can assume that people are being excluded from this game that we're playing, when in fact, people are quite happy to be doing their own thing.
Yeah.
And so it rests upon this logic of inclusion that I think is just false. I think
uh-huh.
that what if we didn't think about it in terms of access and inclusion and thought about it entirely differently? There are simply different modes that have different scales, and people are fully capable of developing the kind of modes of linguistic experimentation and use that are useful for them. People aren't being kept out of experimental poetry because people choose to speak in obscure or erudite ways, or ways that develop certain forms of knowledge and learning.
It's also a logic of inclusion that traffics in a certain familiar set of binary oppositions from the culture wars and the poetry wars that assumes that there's some sort of one-to-one correspondence between certain kinds of cultural forms and certain forms of social or group identity. Whereby the avant-garde gets aligned with sort of originality or experimental formal innovation, and accessibility becomes a sort of rear guard of forms that are left over and available to deal with sort of referential and experiential contents, and the alignment of that with popular and sort of various marginalized subject positions sort of haunts many of these debates between pitting accessibility and the avant-garde as sort of like opposed categories that restricts the audience in each case, along lines that map onto certain sort of identity formations.
Well, and that seems like, you know, that actually reveals a kind of useful divergence between poetry and popular music in a sense, which is that form is actually one of the things that makes popular music feel accessible. Whereas, you know, I think just coming back to the dichotomy you were describing, that form is the thing that becomes problematic in poetry form. You know, form becomes a way of talking about what makes it inaccessible, you know, whereas I think the reverse is actually true for the music we were listening
to. Right, and in poetry in particular, it's not simply that it's inaccessible, but form is also where the sort of positive investment of politics comes from, like the sort of the notion that there's something politically progressive to originality or sort of formal innovation or experiment, which also gets interestingly mixed up once you have sort of Rihanna enter the mix as the sign, as it were, of the politically progressive or sort of emancipatory project of the camp that Occupy Oakland.
I guess I have two things to say. One is a response to that, and one is a question about sort of spatialization and the globe, as it were. But my response is, like, actually, I'm not sure there's such a difference between pop music and poetry, which is to say, like, the rhetoric by which an innovative form is resistant and thus more politically progressive is exactly the same in pop music, which is, like, you listen to college radio, and it's got, like, we refuse to make the American song form, as it's called, right, with bridge chorus, I mean, with first chorus, bridge chorus, and just by doing that, you will know that we are more righteous and thoughtful and caring. In fact, that transposes fairly identically onto the rhetorics around poetry, but also in its identicality sort of also unpersuasively in the binaries that it produces. But I guess a question I want to ask is about the Perloff article and around that, the oppositions that are produced between, like, the identity poetics that she sets forth, and then these are all very, as if modernism in the avant-garde was a first world problem, as we say. And I think there's other ways to talk about the relationship of modernism and the avant-garde, not to these, recondite failures within the same demographic, but in relation to poetic practices in the rest of the world. And I know that some of us have done quite a bit of thinking about that and maybe would like to chime in.
I don't know. I keep trying to figure out, like, what the... I'm trying to think about all the moves that the Rihanna song is doing, which I think are just, like, so multiple, which are a lot of them, like, content based, like you were saying, like it's a metaphoric song that works in that certain way. And then trying to think about, like, what the poetry does. Cause I mean, the poetry is often working in the same way. But then with the kind of, like, without the kind of, like, swelling of emotion that the pop song, that we're culturally conditioned to hear in the pop song that we kind of access at that moment, which is why you're using a pop song and not a T.S. Eliot poem, as a sort of, in a political movement, or even, let's say, a Neruda poem, to be less absurd, in some way, like, that there's a way in which they're working so differently. But, I mean, I think that dichotomy that gets set up doesn't hold finally between a kind of identity politics and a kind of experimental politics, and, like, you can retell that history entirely differently, and not merely differently, but probably more representatively.
I think that actually usefully clarifies the thing I was just trying to figure out about how the allegory between pop songs and college rock goes, which is to say, that thing, like, how well we know the ways that pop songs are coded to get us to feel certain ways, and either we comply with them or we don't. And we don't know those codes as well for poetry. So form works in a different way in that sense. Like, poetry doesn't quite have the same ways to set off the, like, oh, now I know when to put up my lighter and wave it.
Uh-huh. Although in coterie environments we do. The laugh line, you know,
right.
A patter.
Yeah. Oh.
Which gets us to the question of manner. I mean, I feel that that's what is at stake in Perloff's article, that she's accusing a sort of wide swath of American poetry as being highly mannered, and then she turns to this other poetry that she thinks is still marginal,
yeah,
in ways that it's clearly not, and suggests that it's not mannered, and I think that's simply false. I would say that, post-avant-garde or avant-garde American poetry at this point is a body of highly mannered,
yeah,
work, and often in incredibly boring and derivative ways, and it's no less, you know, no less derivative or unoriginal than, you know, the most boring and conventional of workshop poems.
Yeah, I did wonder, like, what she wants. And on the one hand, it's framed, the beginning of the first piece is framed by that very conventional, since the 80s, rise of the MFA, reference to numbers. There's X bazillion poets producing X times 10 bazillion poems, you know. How are we ever going to sift through them all? There's too many. And largeness leads to sameness. So there's a uniformity and a boringness. And what we need is something that isn't the product of that mass production. And then Motvay comes in and says, you're ignoring all these really interesting poets from environments either outside the academy or semi-outside the MFA program. And her response to that is, well, they're not famous, so I can't talk about them. I can't talk about a bunch of unknown poets. So what does she want? She wants something that's not mass-produced, but when the existence of a really lively scene that isn't large is brought to her attention, she seems to want to factor that out. And that seems to me to get back to the point that you made earlier, a person sitting two people to my left, about doing your own thing and why there has to be... I looked just again at the conclusion of either her first piece or her response to Motvay, where she keeps using that notion of a larger public, as if that's always the desideratum for poetry, experimental or otherwise, that it should have a larger public. There should be a lot less of it, and it should have a larger public. Mm-hmm. That's a weird desire.
It seems like there's a middle ground. So there's the larger public that we imagine, and then there's the version where, like, everyone's just playing their own language game, and other people will do their own and not another. It seems to me there is. I don't want to find myself defending the Perlovian position here, but it seems to me there is a desire for a shared game. That's a political desire. It doesn't have to be shared among a larger public. That's a deeply problematic construction. But when I think of, let's say, the Situationist, right, and that endless rhetoric of a shared game, and actually, perhaps I remain a romantic of a certain kind, but I find that language and that account incredibly persuasive, as locked as it is in a kind of alcoholic 50s. I still find that idea that there can be a game and it can be shared, at least among a few comrades, to be an object of desire for me.
And I think to go back to the issue of manner, that... the question of the relationship of the avant-garde to a larger public or even a smaller public with a shared game in the context of the opposition of accessibility and avant-garde seems to presume that the avant-garde itself is a sort of coherent and continuous line, whether it's within sort of the poetry community or the political community. And as even the most cursory sort of examination of the relationship between quote-unquote radical politics and sort of radical literary movements will show that's not the case at all. There's no easy alignment between those two forces, and that seems to return us to the question of whether it even makes sense to think of avant-garde and accessible forms as sort of meaningful or coherent camps at present. And even if we do, if we can sort of assume some sort of historical continuity on either side of that equation that doesn't sort of simply dead end on both sides at this late date in history into various camps with their mannerisms and styles and formalist predilections.
Well, yeah, I mean that's one of the things in that sort of discussion of Matt Bay's, well, here's my group. The model by which there's an oppressed, beleaguered, noble minor tradition, and then this dominant mainstream that's crushing it. It seems more like there's a kind of economy of I think balkanization is the pet term or the pet rock term that everyone uses, and I don't think that's quite right. But there's many of these sort of minor, probably not coterie, but people who are cognizant of each other and working, maybe looking for a kind of shared game, and it becomes a question of how do you produce yours, not as the new major fact, but as the right minor fact, right? As the one that successfully is being marginalized when it shouldn't be and is so important.
Or that has a certain functioning even within the subculture. I mean, the thing that's weird about that article, finally, also, is that it feels like she doesn't quite understand, or she's like looking at what's happening around changes around how poetry gets made and how poetry gets distributed and published, and is kind of confused by them, as we all are. But yet the confusion seems to take a kind of dismissal of it. Like, I'm not sure that there is that dominant mainstream. She doesn't have any numbers on it. And I suspect, like, if you actually did the numerical analysis, even though I know she hates the sociological trend, that it would not actually exist.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not sure that many poets of this dominant mainstream sell more than another poet, finally. I think we're actually seeing a kind of almost even decentralization that's actually fairly interesting.
Well, I also find myself wondering if part of the reason that, you know, that the Perlov essay is confusing because it seems to be asking for some contradictory things is the extent to which there's actually a kind of unspoken nostalgia in it. You know, coming back to the question of audience, you know, for some sort of more ideal audience, you know, a kind of 1960s, 1970s audience for poetry that maybe was both broader and more genuinely interested in which may or may not actually have existed. But, you know, because once that sort of nostalgic desire kind of gets entered in an unspoken way into the conversation, then I think it gets picked up on by the respondent in certain ways. And so I think, I wonder if that's a kind of subterranean thing that's informing some of these confusions.
One of the curious things about the story she tells and the nostalgia it contains is that because there's a restaging of these sort of hackneyed binary oppositions from poetry wars and culture wars in the 1980s, it's sort of curious to posit this as a problem in the present when... As many of us know, the language poets themselves thought that there was already this problem with the sort of dominant, hegemonic, soul-crushing sameness of the workshop model poem in the 80s themselves. So it's actually unclear what she thinks the new set of facts is that has suddenly made this more the case.
And that really, like, her having a question as if it's a new question when it is indeed a rather old question maps on nicely to the conceptuals, which she's so interested in, as if they had a new project when they really don't. The question they ask is not particularly interesting to me anymore. Like, what is creation? What is authenticity? What is it really to make? Like, yes, we know this is a very interesting question in the 20th century. It's scarcely new. It's not clear to me what they've added to it. It's a question that is not among the questions I feel I want to find out the answer to in the current poetic, political, cultural world situation that we're in. And so, like, her presentation of an old and not particularly pressing question as if it is the current flashpoint maps onto her object having that same sort of problem.
And I think that itself maps onto a technological understanding of history in which she feels that the internet gives her the warrant to reinvent the 80s, you know. So that that is like what, you know, what they're all, the conceptual poets themselves are leaning on, and that's why they're not at all boring in the ways they want us to find them boring. I mean, whatever, read 10,000 pages of one of those books, that's fine. They're boring in the claims they make about themselves. That's what's boring, is it turns out it's like a New York Times piece on the rise of the internet and how we live now. Who cares, you know? I also had another anecdote that goes back to one of the points that was made before. I was sitting in an administrative meeting in the university where I teach, and there was a pretty famous poet in his, I would say, late 60s sitting next to me who confided in me that poets he knew in his generation were really, really depressed because Knopf and FSG were really pretty much no longer committed to printing poetry. And for him, basically, this was the end of American poetry because those presses were factoring out poems. And I was agog. I mean, I flashed to like 100 books of poetry beautifully designed, inventively produced, circulated in what may very well be nearly equivalent numbers to the numbers that FSG or Knopf would end up selling. And I felt kind of sad for him, you know?
Well, so what we can say is the situation for poetry right now is that there aren't many people who read poetry who don't also write it. And the numbers are probably about equal for the so-called mainstream and the so-called experimental or avant-garde wing of things. But where it might not be the same is how many... let me say this. There's one group of people who aren't poets and who read poetry, and that is a certain class of academics who aren't themselves poets. And I think that what this is about in some ways is about... competing for the hegemony that will allow you to secure this crucial group of people that happens to be very small, but who gets read by the kind of specialist critics of poetry who aren't themselves poets and who is going to assign those books to their classes and you know, establish a certain amount of notoriety for these works. And I think that actually in that regard, the experimental and avant-garde wing of things is winning. And so it's quite ridiculous for Marjorie to suggest that, you know, the mainstream is still this dominant force. What the mainstream, the so-called mainstream, still has is a fair amount of money tied up in various prizes and institutions. Mm-hmm. But that turns out to be almost entirely irrelevant in terms of fame or publishing numbers, mm-hmm. numbers of books sold.
Yeah.
So,
but what the article and these questions seems to suggest is that because this experimental or avant-garde wing is not tied up with the prizes, that they necessarily have a leftist or radical political inclination that extends beyond their poetics. And what I would like to emphasize is this kind of yawning gap between a politics of content that is in the poems and an actually lived praxis, which has little to no relationship to this avant-garde or experimental wing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that brings me around to the initial Rihanna and the Oakland Commune dynamic in the mirror, or inverted in some sense, which is that a truth that gets effaced in this discussion, as Perloff and others forward it, is that the struggle is not just for hegemony over this sort of position of the avant-garde that has a lot of cultural force, actually, insofar as poetry goes, but the struggle is consistently to produce an apolitical avant-garde, right? Like, that's the way you get that hegemony in the current situation, is not that the avant-garde, you assume it automatically has a claim on some kind of politics out of some historical ground or some abstract optimism, but in fact, the struggle is to produce the avant-garde insofar as it exists as an apolitical, formalist terrain.
And, you know, one of the things that gives a lie to that periodically for me is, like, when I try to analogize these discussions to other forms of cultural practice, like, there are too many guitar teachers in this country, and kids everywhere are strumming away idiotically on their guitars and writing their dumb songs. There's X million songs out there, and only 10 of them will ever be really good, and we should be concerned about that. Or, like, there's way too many swim instructors, and only 10 of those kids out of a million are going to become Olympic. You know, I mean, no one talks about that, and that's because there's absence.
And which is an unaddressed problem in our
Exactly. And the reason it's not is because it's not freighted with that inappropriate political way, as though there were a correlation between those two things.
Right.
I think that's it for us, Joshua. Cue song.
Yellow down. Okay.